Welcome to American Countdown, another edition as we approach day 70, 80, or 90, depending on where you're in the world in lockdown. But at least finally, more parts of the country, more parts of the West, more parts of the United States are reopening. Indeed, it would be hard to sustain a lockdown after so many of these Democratic politicians and members of the press and even health experts called for people to have mass public participation in mass protests that ended up resulting in major riots over this past week or 2 weeks. Indeed, in that context, if we look at image number one, we see a lawyer in Florida who was ordering body bags for people in the name of because they were out going to the beach in Florida. He said, beginning next Saturday, I will have a team handing out free body bags throughout the state to the Florida beachgoers. Each body bag costs $10. He asked for people to send him money to help give him the body bags. And these were people that were out in the sunlight and the rest. But what did he tweet out when it was time to do the protesting for Black Lives Matter? We are here in the Florida Panhandle, where hundreds have turned out for peaceful protest. No peace, no justice. He was out there joining him. Somehow the virus was magically immune. If you were a left-wing protester, the virus knows not to touch you. But if you were just a good old beach lover, by golly, it was going to attack you. Even if you were swimming by yourself, surfing by yourself, bicycling by yourself, or walking by yourself, all of whom were either arrested, fined, or cited, or attempted to by various authorities because of attitudes like that one. In the same context, the attitudes in the, about the origins of the Wuhan virus, as we've been discussing on this show, is that there's increasing evidence, even all the way back, that the virus came from a lab or was connected to a lab. There's more reports about that. But in addition to that, there are more reports about whether or not the virus, in fact, is actually originated far earlier than was publicly reported. People have been looking at heat maps of hospitals over the last 2 years in Wuhan. And what they discovered was that there was a sudden surge, massive surge of hospitalizations in October of 2019. Many people had rumored that, in fact, the virus had broken out in October. This was connected to those people who believed that it was a leak from the Wuhan lab. And this additional data and evidence further supports it and substantiates it. As this article in CNBC states, satellite images and online searches, this is based on online search activity in China, as well as other components, indicate China had the coronavirus all the way back in the fall in October, and that a Harvard study confirms the same results. This is further evidence that, in fact, it may have been leaked from a lab, which would explain why China was keeping it suppressed for so long. But it also meant that exponential growth rate that people had forecast based on thinking the virus only arose in China in late January was always wrong. In the same context, the Prime Minister of Spain has confirmed that the pandemic caused a lot of excess deaths among people who did not have COVID. In other words, the lockdowns in large parts of the world increased the death rate and caused the deaths themselves by people not getting cancer treatments, not getting heart treatments, not getting liver treatments, not getting hospital medications, not getting a range of treatments that they needed, not to mention the suicides and depression and anxiety and the rest and the health consequences that are attendant to it from people being in lockdown for so long, deprived of the opportunity to go outside, deprived of the opportunity to go to parks, to go to beaches, to associate with one another, to be able to be outside of the house and not be simply in confined quarters constantly and continuously. As we said from the get-go, the lockdown is what was going to kill people, not just the economy, a lot more so than the virus did. And now even left-leaning European presidents and prime ministers are admitting that is in fact what occurred. In the same context, there was we've also been talking about on this show whether or not there would be a push against hydroxychloroquine. And we've had people like MD James Todaro and others on the show going through all of the benefits, a product, a drug or medication, a therapeutic that has more than 7 decades of proven medical benefits. In the malaria context, so we know whether it causes other risk because we've had the benefit of more than 70 years of medical research on it and medical success with its use, whether or not that would be suppressed as a possible therapeutic in exchange for patented products where people that are connected to Fauci, where people that are connected to other politicians across the country could get rich based on pushing a patented alternative to hydroxychloroquine for which they would need to suppress arguments concerning the utility and the benefit of hydroxychloroquine or even spread false data about test results. We predicted that several months ago. We even said people should look at investing in those companies that are developing the patented products because they're likely to get the complicit support, as Big Pharma typically does, of those particular politicians and those in power and in the press. And that is, in fact, what had happened. A report from the VA that had exaggerated data downplayed the utility and benefit of hydroxychloroquine. Well, as soon as there was any data suggesting patented product alternatives could work, those patented product alternatives were immediately pushed and propagated by people connected to Duke, who are also connected to Wuhan University in China, also connected to Fauci, also connected to other members that sit on the boards of the government agencies that will make these decisions, often whom have stock in those companies making those patented products. Big Pharma's long complicity with government actors to push their own agenda at the expense of health alternatives, unpatented alternatives, is a frequent component of what really the FDA does. The FDA is Big Pharma's aid in suppressing independent small competition from organic natural health alternatives. That's what they're really about. FDA doesn't really discipline the major Big Pharma companies very often at all, aside from looking like they're policing them just enough to create the political credibility in what they do. It goes back to Upton Sinclair, who wrote the book The Jungle way back in the early 1900s, to describe the horrific working conditions of people in meatpacking plants and elsewhere in the in Chicago especially, but also across the country. And then later, the only result was a range of regulatory products that were mostly intended to boost the perception of American meat factories in the United States. As Upton Sinclair would later say, I aimed for people's heart and accidentally hit their stomach instead. The same is true of much of the federal regulatory infrastructure and superstructure that governs agencies like the FDA, where they have been captured. They call it regulatory capture in some of the legal and political terminology, which its whole and sole goal is to propagate and promote Big Pharma at the expense of independent health, including natural health, organic health, such as the products that are supported by our sponsor, InfoWarsStore.com. InfoWarsStore doesn't promote Big Pharma products, doesn't promote patented products, instead promotes products that have had a long history of natural health benefits to people over decades, over centuries, over civilizations, over countries around the world. Whether it's Chill Force or Brain Force or a wide range of products, whether it's Knockout, things that help you sleep, things that help you wake up, things that help you focus, things that help you deal with anxiety or stress, or it's just basic products like the best coffee. Some of the best coffee anywhere in the world in terms of that comes from the southern part of Mexico and parts of Central America. That is also available. You can also get a wide range of products that support your political beliefs, T-shirts, bumper stickers, anything else that you like that you believe in. But the big part of the competition of organic natural health alternatives to Big Pharma, which wants to control your mind, control your body, to control your pocketbook, is the pushing of those questionable products that are patented at the expense of those that are not. Well, now there's further evidence. The Lancet and the New England Journal of Medicine tried to push a study that claimed that somehow, magically overnight, hydroxychloroquine became a terrible product for people and would cause all these negative problems and could not at all be beneficial. Well, now, in fact, they've had to retract every single one of those studies. Lancet is retracting it. The New England School of Journal of Medicine is retracting it. As this headline reveals, in uncoverdc.com, politicized science, Lancet and the New England School of Journal of New England Journal of Medicine must retract and do retract studies on hydroxychloroquine. Indeed, it turned out the study was, quote, a fake study that was not rooted in the data. This was, in fact, exposed by the MD that had been on our show, James Todaro, who's developed an independent site about independent medical information concerning the medical and health and particularly pharmacological therapeutic treatments and which ones work and which ones don't and which ones have evidence and which ones do not. In that same context and in that same capacity, we've seen a wide range of political beliefs pushed upon and propagated upon the public at the expense of common sense and basic decency. Today, a police officer went out and defended his fellow police officers against the false accusations from BLM, the fake narratives from the media, the fake stories from the press. Let's take a look at video clip number two.
I'm the president of the New York State Association of PBAs, and I just want to talk to you, the press, and I want to talk to the police right officers. 375 million interactions with the public every year. 375 million interactions. Overwhelmingly positive responses. Overwhelmingly positive responses. But I read in the papers all week, we all read in the papers, that in the black community, mothers are worried about their children getting home from school without being killed by a cop. What world are we living in? That doesn't happen. It does not happen. I am not Derek Chauvin. They are not him. He killed someone. We didn't. We are restrained. And you know what? I'm saying this to all the cops here. Because you know what? Everybody's trying to shame us. The legislators, the press, everybody's trying to shame us into being embarrassed about our profession. Well, you know what? This isn't stained by someone in Minneapolis. It's still got a shine on it. And so do theirs. So do theirs. Stop treating us like animals and thugs and start treating us with some respect. That's what we're here today to say. We've been left out of the conversation. We've been vilified. It's disgusting. It's disgusting. Trying to make us embarrassed of our profession. 375 million interactions. Overwhelmingly, overwhelmingly positive. Nobody talks about all the police officers that were killed in the last week in the United States of America, and there were a number of them. We don't condone Minneapolis. We roundly reject what he did as disgusting. It's disgusting. It's not what we do. It's not what police officers do. Our legislators abandoned us. The press is vilifying us. Well, you know what, guys? I'm proud to be a cop, and I'm going to continue to be proud to be a cop until the day I retire. And that's all I have to say.
That police officer's right and righteous indignation is justifiable under the circumstances taking place. Consider the president's tweet today concerning the Buffalo protester who was pushed down, Martin Gugino, and he just simply laid out what One America News Network and others like The Last Refuge and the Conservative Treehouse have also pushed out, that in fact this was someone who, that the accusations against the police officers are overstated, and pretending that this individual was just a old school, nice old guy who just wanted to chat with the police, who just decided to randomly brutalize them and push them down, was probably not the most truthful or accurate narrative. Indeed, if you dug into the story, you knew that Gugino had a long history of being involved with radical protest groups that often use not only civil disobedience, but various forms of violence and trespass to achieve their objectives. Hence the president's suggestion that maybe this is an Antifa-connected individual trying to assist or aid Antifa in their objectives was not all that unreasonable. Indeed, if you look closely at this video we're about to show, it appears that, first of all, he approaches police in a place where it doesn't appear he has a legal right to do so. He's trespassing on them, sort of blocking them. But what triggered the concern, there's no immediate reaction by the police, even though he's technically blocking them. Put it this way, if he was a kid from Covington, Kentucky with a hat on that said Make America Great Again, the entire press would accuse him of completely blocking a legitimate activity, as they did to the Covington kids falsely and incorrectly. He's actually blocking them in what he decides to do in his interface. But more importantly, it appears he's doing something with some device in his hand that appears to be trying to get something, whether it's trying to get identification information, block other forms of communication. There's other people who looked at it and they believe they identified what he was trying to do, which was basically interfere with the police officer's ability to do their job that day with their communications technology. Let's take a look at video clip number one. So you see him going back and forth with this device where he's trying to get something from them. In other words, and it's when he did it a fourth time that they pushed him. So this isn't somebody, hey, how you doing? Nice to see you, George. That's not what's going on. Right away, he's got this device out. He's blocking him. He's literally blocking them at that point. He's not willing to move back, even though they're trying to move him back. And he keeps flashing this device that appears to be trying to interfere with, track, or get some information off of it. Other people that have looked at it, like Conservative Treehouse and others, have said that, in fact, it is a common technique designed to interfere with the police's ability to communicate the device that he's using and what he's trying to do. And it's when they figure that out that they finally push him back. When, by the way, he's the one who walks up to them, not them to him. He's the one who stops and then blocks them. They start to push and try to move forward. He refuses to. And then he's doing this weird thing with the device that appears to be doing something that somebody triggers a concern for that leads the person behind him to push him. Is that worthy of a felony charge against the police officers? Is this poor old innocent nice little protester just golly gee the police being mean to him for no reason? I don't think so. That doesn't even make logical sense. And the president's right. He falls back to a degree that seems disproportionate to the push. Whether he intended to or not, whether he's trying to exaggerate the result or he's just old and lost his balance, whatever the dynamic may be, he's the one who initiated and instigated the action, and it appears he's trying to do something illicit, and he's got a long history of being a part of groups that do precisely that. So aside from the press saying that this is somehow impermissible, this is the president spreading false conspiracy theories that One America News Network should never be listened to, an actual view of the actual evidence provides more support for the president's theory than the poor golly gee old guy just got randomly pushed by vicious cops when he just wanted to chat with old George. So there's yet to be an explanation from the people defending Gugino as to what he is doing there. Why is he walking up to them? Why is he blocking their path? Why is he not moving back? Why is he flashing? And most importantly, why is he flashing some device that appears to be trying to track something or get something or record something off of the police officer? The only good explanations have been explanations that suggest he was trying to interfere with the police officer's ability and the whole police department's ability to do their job that day, such as maybe intercepting their radio signal or something else. Those have been the various explanations with those with the technological and technical know-how to explain his course of conduct much better than his defenders have. But in that same context, Tucker Carlson had a righteous rant last night about what has been taking place in the country, and it's well worth listening to again. Let's play video clip number six.
Good evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson Tonight. Every cult has the same goal, the utter submission of its members. Cult members surrender everything. They give up their physical freedom, where they can go, who they can see, how they can dress. But more than that, they give up control of their minds. Cult leaders determine what their followers are allowed to believe, even in their most private thoughts. In order to do this, cults separate people from all they have known before. They force their members to renounce their former lives, their countries, their customs. They allow no loyalty except to the cult. The first thing they attack always is the family. Families are the main impediment to brainwashing and extremism. That's true in every culture. So if you're going to control individuals, if you're going to transform free people into compliant robots, the first thing you must do is separate them from the ones who love them most. In 1932, Soviet authorities began promoting the story of a 13-year-old peasant boy called Pavlik Morozov. Morozov, they claimed, had taken the supremely virtuous step of denouncing his own father to the secret police for committing counter-revolutionary acts. Once exposed as a traitor, the boy's father was executed by firing squad for the safety of the state. Joseph Stalin elevated this boy to the status of national hero for what he did. People wept in the streets when they heard his name. They worshipped him like a saint. Why are we telling you this? Because it's happening here. In the last 10 days, some of our most prominent citizens have sworn allegiance to a cult. Converts go by the term allies, and like all cult members, they demand total conformity. They ritually condemn their own nation, its history, its institutions, its symbols, its flag. They denounce their own parents. If you've been on social media recently, you've likely seen many videos like this one.
You stupid I'm sorry, you guys.
That is a child attacking her mother and father for the crime of insufficient loyalty to Black Lives Matter. Reporter Hannah Lustig of Insider.com wrote about that video, and she strongly approved of it. What you just saw, Lustig wrote, is a young person, quote, modeling the most important tenet of allyship. Modeling, meaning something done to encourage others to do the same. It's effective, and in this case, it's working. Here's a 15-year-old from Louisiana called Isabella. There are many like her in America right now.
I literally hate my family so much. It's just... they just try to argue with me that George Floyd doesn't, like... they're just trying to tell me that, like, he deserved that because he did something wrong and that it was okay. That is not okay. And it's just making me so upset. I don't know why. I do not want to live here. I hate living in Louisiana. I hate living around these racist... I just want to leave.
I hate my family so much. Just a week ago, it would have been hard to imagine that. Now, Isabella is a social media star. Celebrities tweet their approval at her. She may have her own cult following before long. But the revolution is young. Children attacking their parents is just the beginning. On CNN today, a man called Tim Wise told viewers that going forward, parents must hurt their own children.
I think the important thing for white parents to keep in the front of our mind is that if black children in this country are not allowed innocence and childhood without fear of being killed by police or marginalized in some other way, then our children don't deserve innocence. If Tamir Rice can be shot dead in a public park, playing with a toy gun, something white children do all over this country every day without the same fear of being shot. If Tamir Rice can be killed, then white children need to be told at least at the same age. If they can't be innocent, we don't get to be innocent.
Your children are no longer allowed to be innocent, says Tim Wise. Happy childhoods are a sign of racism. The man saying this and being affirmed by CNN's anchors as he does is a self-described anti-racism activist. He's been saying things like this for a long time. More than once, Tim Wise has suggested that he approves of violence against those who disagree. How does Tim Wise make a living? Well, in part by lecturing students. Your kids may have seen him speak. They've almost certainly heard a lot of people like Tim Wise. In America's schools, the revolution has been in progress for quite some time. Rochester School District in New York has created a Black Lives Matter-themed lesson plan. The teaching materials dismiss America's bedrock institutions, indeed America itself, as inherently racist. Suggested questions for students include, how does mass incarceration function as a mechanism of racialized social control? One specific racial group is singled out for exclusive blame. The curriculum promotes a book entitled White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. In other words, children, there's a reason hatred and inequality exist. These people did it. That's what your kids are learning right now. That's not an overstatement. Yesterday at Darien High School in Connecticut, Principal Ellen Dunn sent an email to parents in which she promised to increase the, quote, race-conscious education of our students. In order to achieve that, Dunn distributed materials from the Southern Poverty Law Center. Now, ironically, the Southern Poverty Law Center is itself a hate group that has been documented extensively. But now their agenda is the school's agenda. It's what your kids are learning. In Washington, D.C., an elementary school principal in the affluent northwest section of the city recently wrote a letter announcing that, quote, we need more white parents to talk to their kids about race, especially now. The letter singled out, quote, white staff and white community members, whom the principal alleged had committed, quote, both macro and microaggressions against staff of color. The principal did not specify what those crimes were. She didn't need to. Their skin color was their crime. This is a national theme. It pains us to tell you that, but it's true. It's incredibly destructive and dangerous. Countless school districts are now using the 1619 Project from the New York Times, for example, as a curriculum. That project is the work of an out-of-the-closet racial extremist called Nicole Hannah Jones. Jones, for example, recently argued it is not violence to loot and burn stores. It's justified. Her propaganda is now mandatory in public schools in Buffalo, Chicago, Newark, Washington. Many parents understandably deeply resent this. It's deranged. It's racist. But others don't. They are allies, and they've joined in. One mother in London, where the cult is also spreading, posted this photo on Twitter. It's of her daughter on bended knee holding a sign declaring her privilege. The cultural revolution has come to the West. What will the effects of this be? This is just a moment. It will end. How will we feel about it looking back? Years from now, how will that little girl with the sign remember her childhood? Her mother took Tim Wise's advice. She no longer has innocence. Will she be grateful for that? It's hard to imagine she will be. More likely, she will feel bitter and used because she has been used. And it's likely that many children growing up right now will feel the same way. Is there a single person who believes that this moment we're living through will end in racial harmony? That used to be what we wanted. Some of us still do want that. Is it even a goal anymore? It doesn't seem like it. Instead, it seems like many in power, it's very clear, in fact, that many in power are pushing hard for racial division, for hatred, for violence. And let's pray they don't get what they want. Tribal conflict will destroy a country faster than any plague. But keep in mind, as this insanity continues, that it doesn't happen in a vacuum. Every action provokes a reaction. That's physics. We don't know where this is going. We don't want to know where it's going. The cult members should stop now, immediately, before more innocents get hurt, and they will if they don't.
Indeed, if we look at the actual data from a Monmouth poll, which is a very liberal university poll, asked African Americans, how satisfied are you with your local police department? 72% said they were satisfied. Indeed, only 5% said they were very dissatisfied. More than four times as many as that said they were very satisfied with their police department. In the same context, polls show that over 70% support using the National Guard to put down the looting and the rioting. Indeed, if we go back to looking at the Detroit riot of 1967 and how it was covered, if you dig into some of the stories they didn't tell, local neighbors and local African Americans from the community identified that they considered the problem being outside organized groups and others trying to cause and stir up trouble, not a legitimate response to the police, even back then. Let's take a look at video clip number four.
If they do that, they're gonna go back to rioting, you know.
There's trouble. You think it's just spontaneous, or how do you feel about that?
No, I don't think it's spontaneous. You mean the
firing and the
sniper firing and so forth.
From the beginning on Sunday.
From the beginning on Sunday. Yeah. Well, I think that's what's spontaneous. But after it all began, I believe these various groups, these radical groups, yeah. They come in and they see this as a golden opportunity to keep something going.
Indeed, what they reported there is would be reported still today and is reflected in the polling data. Up next, we'll be discussing this and other issues with Gavin McInnes of Censor TV, who's had his own dealings with Antifa.
The real reason you should buy our new atomic iodine spray is because atomic iodine is so incredibly good for your body, and because almost no one else is on the market selling true atomic iodine. Now, it's listeners that started about 4 months ago begging for us to put a spray bottle on our X2 iodine. So we looked into it, and the formula we have is not best delivered through a spray bottle. So we went to scientists and developers, and they said, actually, it's another great way to aerosolize it and deliver it into the body to reformulate it with this particular type of glycerin and this type of spray bottle. But the real reason I went ahead and decided to develop this is I don't like having to take the bottle of X2 around with me that's got the dropper. That's good for at home, in my medicine cabinet, and in my kitchen. But then I tend to forget when I'm on the road or I'm on a business trip or vacation to take it with me. And the spray bottle is really a refreshing way to do it. It also soothes my throat and my larynx. I obviously talk a lot. And so once we got in some of the test bottles a few months ago, I was blown away. And I'm now personally hooked on it, and this is the way I like to take my X2. So it's proprietary, it just came in, it's 33% off, it's amazing. And if you don't know what iodine is and why it's so important. The soils are depleted. Most of the food is depleted. Most of the other types of iodine that are out there are bound to other substances, and the body has trouble absorbing them. That's not the case with our nascent iodine system. It's atomic. It's pure. It's very, very clean. And what it does for your thyroid, the rest of your body, is, quote, essential. Iodine is essential. Like oxygen, like water. You have to have it, and one of the best ways to get it is the original X2, or now X2, in the spray bottle. I would take advantage of this right now. I'm very excited about it. By having it in the car, I don't forget to take it. And again, we're discounting it out of the gates at 33% off at InfoWarsStore.com.
We'll be up next with Gavin McInnes. In this respect, the one aspect of both the rioting and the looting and the lockdown and the pandemic is the consistent pattern of disproportionately harming the poorest and the working class communities in the country. Indeed, according to this article in New Geography, Pandemics and Pandemonium, the lockdown has, quote, disproportionately devastated poorer communities. Indeed, roughly half of all U.S. job losses in April were in low-paying fields. Indeed, almost half of the people who make under $40,000 a year were the ones to lose their jobs, and those are many of the jobs that have not yet come back. And yet, those are the same communities being disproportionately hurt by the looting as well. So the lockdown and the looting have combined and conspired to hurt working-class Americans more than any other group in the country. Meanwhile, much of the medical predicate for all of this was the myth that there could be extraordinary spread amongst asymptomatic people. In other words, children who generally were not showing symptoms, other people who were not showing symptoms, a large portion of people typically in response to a virus do not have symptomatic aspects of the virus, of any virus. There's always going to be a percentage that simply are asymptomatic. There was a lot of evidence from both the Diamond Princess and the aircraft carrier that, in fact, there are a large number of people who would be asymptomatic. The children were generally asymptomatic of this virus, but the myth was that didn't matter because asymptomatic people could even spread the virus at a high rate, even though all of the evidence was this was a virus that required a high viral load to be spread through the air, and that requires someone who's symptomatic, not asymptomatic. Well, even the World Health Organization had to admit yesterday that, in fact, asymptomatic spread of the virus is, quote, very rare. So it turns out that what some of us were saying almost 3 months ago is now having to even be admitted and conceded by the World Health Organization. Another article in the Wall Street Journal, so where did the virus come from, admitting that new research has deepened rather than dispelled the mystery surrounding the origin of COVID-19. Indeed, the explanation of bats or wildlife markets or possibly pangolins appears increasingly less a credible explanation. In fact, there is more and increasing evidence that a laboratory played at least some role in the spread of the virus in the first place, as we had also been reporting here for several months. As reported in The Hill, it wasn't just religious liberty that Chief Justice Roberts strangled in denying relief from the California case that reached the Supreme Court. The liberals on the court, all four of them, upheld the California governor's restrictions that were discriminatory and disproportionate and disparate to churches, not allowing them to organize and more than 100 people in a church and not allowing more than 25% of the congregation to be present, while similar places, restaurants, various facilities, various bars, various clubs, various kinds of other places, depending on the nature of them, could operate at 50% capacity, double that. And of course, the governor was happy to greenlight all the mass protests that ultimately led to looting throughout California the last week or so. Yet the Supreme Court decision came down to Chief Justice Roberts, who made the decision that I was forecasting a couple of months ago as the great risk, which is that Korematsu, the famous decision where the Supreme Court greenlit the deprivation of rights of millions of Americans simply because they had some Japanese ancestry in their family history, would be repeated. That there's a long history of our courts turning a blind eye to government abuses whenever the governments just say the word crisis, crisis. All of a sudden, magically, the Constitution tends to vanish as courts become scared and nervous and afraid to simply enforce constitutional rights and constitutional remedies. Chief Justice Roberts is the classic archetype of just such a judge and justice. And of course, it was no great surprise, though a great disappointment, that he was the deciding vote and said that the discriminatory rulings against the church weren't really discriminatory. Didn't quite explain that with compelling logic, but mostly said, let's defer to these politicians in these tough times of crisis. That was really what he did. And that's why he dangerously and imperiled the rights and remedies of all of us in a constitutional context now and in the future, whenever the politicians can just say the magic word virus or the magic word crisis and have the Constitution disappear. Someone who has dealt with and had to respond to and deal with not only Antifa, but deal with a wide range of issues of suppression of speech and core fundamental liberties is our next guest, and that's Gavin McInnes. Gavin, are you there? Do we got him?
Hey, I can't hear anything.
We can hear you though, but maybe we'll check on that in a second. We'll be right back with Gavin in a second. Gavin McInnes sort of started out with connected to Vice, the publication, and sort of made hipster in the origins of the day. And then 9/11 happened, and that started to change his perspective on American and international and world politics. That led him to look at things from a new perspective and ultimately broach out on his own. His independent idiosyncratic perspective, which was rooted in sort of a traditional kind of conservatism, but had libertarian components to it and populist attributes to it, made him one of the more popular people in the new political populist right movement of the last decade or so that led in part to the election of President Donald Trump. His successes led to him being targeted by a wide range of opponents and adversaries. He started a small group, Proud Boys, just to sit around and sort of have some fun and enjoy life and enjoy their fellow company, that ultimately became a target of Antifa and others. So whenever, because the Proud Boys simply made the proposition to stand up to potential violence by groups like Antifa. Indeed, what was the consequence? Ultimately, when Antifa threatened to beat up and harass a group of people that were involved with a speaking event, and several members associated with Proud Boys simply defended themselves, it was the Proud Boys that ended up facing prosecution, not Antifa. And it was the Proud Boys who ended up facing criminal punishment and time in New York jails and prisons, while the same prosecutor is letting anyone involved in the rioting and looting, for the most part, as he's publicly stated, walk. That gives you a mindset of how the political complicity and political implications of those movements and aspects have continued unabated and cause the kind of harm that we're seeing now. If you had followed Gavin's story, you could have predicted and forecast what was coming. But McInnes was also the subject of a wide range of censorship, from Twitter to Facebook to YouTube to any form of social media location where the platform that controls it is not an independent platform. That is why independent organizations like our sponsor, InfoWarsStore.com, is critical, because it provides a platform for independent voices to be heard and is not controlled by big tech trying to operate a big brother Orwellian focus. By contrast, to give you an idea of the insanity and the inanity of what has been taking place in recent time, consider this headline. Georgetown professor laments that the D.C. rioters didn't get to attack the Trump Hotel. That's the mindset and mentality of these people and individuals. Just as they were obsessed with suppressing the speech and disbanding the Proud Boys for simply trying to defend people's exercise of free speech against Antifa, they're mad that the rioters and looters didn't take advantage of the opportunity to riot and loot and destroy the Trump Hotel. That is the mindset. And that's a Georgetown professor. That's not some random schmuck. In the same context, there's now been a list of all the people already charged by the U.S. District Attorney's Office in various districts across the country, and what may go down as the largest number of arrests and prosecutions by the United States government for systematic and systemic riots across the country in American history. Indeed, the list of federal riot charges, and there's actually a federal riot statute, the Insurrection Act, that allows the president to employ the National Guard, is in fact predicated upon a riot statute that criminalizes certain riot conduct. And just going through it, Middle District of Florida, John Wesley Mobley Jr., false impersonation of a federal officer, Western District of Pennsylvania, Melquan Barnett, malicious destruction of property using fire or explosives. Sidney T. Parshall, a.k.a. Kiwi, Andrew Lyman, William Loomis, all charged with conspiracy to damage and destroy by fires and explosives. Wesley Summers in the Middle District of Tennessee, malicious destruction of property using fire or explosives. The Northern District of Illinois, Timothy O'Donnell, arson. The Northern District of Illinois, which is Chicago, Brandon Pegas and Amber Peltzer, felon in possession of a firearm at the local rioting activities taking place. In New Jersey, Justin Spry, attempt to damage government by fire. By government property by fire. The Northern District of Texas, Emmanuel Quinones, interstate threatening communications. Minnesota, Garrett Patrick Ziegler, Fernandos Cortez Henderson, charged with arson and possession of Molotov cocktails. Western District of New York, that's Buffalo in the Rochester region. Cortland Renford, attempting to destroy a building used in interstate commerce by trying to burn the Buffalo City Hall during the weekend rioting. In Minnesota, Matthew Lee Rupert, involved in civil disorders, riots, and unregistered firearms. In Eastern District of New York, Uroj Rahman, causing damages by fire and explosives, attempting using Molotov cocktail attacks on the New York Police Department. The same in Arizona, more cases in New Jersey, Southern District of Illinois, Eastern District of Missouri, Massachusetts, Utah, Western District of Kentucky, all of them involving possessing illegal weapons, trying to commit civil disorder, trying to have a possession of a destructive device, with various forms of rioting, Molotov cocktails, arson, attempted things to blow up buildings and hurt people. The same in the Eastern District of North Carolina, arson, trying to set fire to police vehicles. Western District of Wisconsin, illegal possession of firearms, three different people attempting to riot and conspire to commit rioting. In Nevada, attempts to conspire to commit arson, three more people prosecuted. Western District of Missouri, attacking officers. Western District of New York, trying to create rioting and multiple forms of arson. Northern District of Illinois, Central District of Illinois, Northern District of New York, that's up near the state capital. Middle District of Florida, that's Tampa and Orlando. Western District of Pennsylvania, that's Pittsburgh. Eastern District of Wisconsin, that's Milwaukee. Northern District of Ohio, that can be Cleveland and that part of the country. Just prosecution after prosecution, indictment after indictment, arrest after arrest, all across the nation. So the next time the press says, these were mostly peaceful protesters, recognize that long list and litany of federal indictments, federal charges, federal arrests in district after district after district, from coast to coast, from north to south, from east to west, across the country in short order. In the same context that the media continues to try to mislead about the protests, and when they've done polling there, a majority of African Americans and a majority of working class people across the country say that the riots were not mostly peaceful protests, that there was more looting and more rioting and more arson than there were peaceful protests taking place. The only group of people who says, oh no, mostly what was going on was peaceful protest, was in fact a small limited group of people, and that would be upper middle class white liberal Democrats. That's the only portion of the entire country they found in the poll that bought the media's fake narrative. Everybody else, including Latinos, including African Americans, including Native Americans, including Asian Americans, and including working class white Americans, all agree that it was predominantly looting, rioting, and violence taking place, not peaceable protests taking place. In that same context, in that same category, we can look at a recent study that managed to have a headline that was actually rebutted by the internal data. The headline talked about how the lockdowns worked, and you dug into it, and all it did was assume that because the models predicted doom and gloom never occurred, then by golly, it must be because the lockdowns worked. But they actually studied whether in comparing cities, counties, states, and countries and regions of the world as to which strategy led to a reduction in any observed data or information. And what they found was that travel bans had no, in fact, had apparently a slight negative effect in terms of spread, not a positive effect at reducing spread. Same with suspending transit. Same with school closures, same with church closures, same with public banning all gatherings. Indeed, as a general rule, the only things that had some positive effect were limiting mass public gatherings appeared to be associated with positive effects, but that was it. There was no other evidence that any other part of the world actually benefited from any aspects of the lockdown, and many of them were, as we noted from the Spain Prime Minister report, actually negative or adverse in time. Indeed, if we look at chart number 20, we'll see COVID deaths over time in Georgia. Remember, Georgia was one of the first big states to open up. And when it did so, it was able to reduce its death rate continually. It continued to go on. It just, for example, if you look up, it reached a peak, then it started to decline. Then they said, you know what, you can go ahead and open. And the decline actually got more aggressive. It actually got even better than when they opened up than it was over lockdown. By the way, over the weekend, the New York Times, this is why the media cannot be trusted as a broad category, whether reporting about looting or reporting about lockdowns, whether reporting about race relations or reporting about pandemics, is that they actually had their opinion editor fired simply for having an opinion put on the pages of the New York Times that the various millennial types didn't like, and that the Maoist mental approach to social control and political control and thought control didn't like. But this is the same New York Times, simply by Senator Cotton, who said, by the way, maybe we should use the Army or the National Guard to deal with all the rioting and looting, a position that, by the way, more than 70% of Americans agreed with. That simply stating that was so upsetting and offensive to the New York Times that it required the firing and resignation of their editor. But here's an editorial they had no problem with. Pedophilia, a disorder, not a crime. So that's not problematic at all at the New York Times, but saying something that more than 70% of Americans agree with is deeply troubling and problematic. In the same context and in the same capacity, we should look at a range of data and information as to what is taking place. One of the proposals of defunding the police that has been propounded is this quote. Rather than strangers armed with guns, the BLM has stated that first responders should be mental health providers, social workers, victim advocates, and other community members in less visible roles. That is the mindset and the mentality that is being propounded as a general rule. In the same capacity, we have headlines like this. Drew Brees' wife, Brittany, issues apology. She says we are the problem. In the same mindset of the Cultural Revolution, where you had to concede and confess your problematic behavior in order to be let back into the community. In the same components, we see things like the state and federal agencies are continuing to investigate links between these same groups that they're bowing to and they're conceding to, between violence and Antifa across the United States. And as we saw, it's already resulted in more than 35 federal prosecutions and arrests. Meanwhile, you continue to see a counter-narrative suppressed within the press and the public for the most part, such as Lil Wayne, the famous rapper who said he was saved by a white cop, so he couldn't have or voice any problem with white police as a general rule. Indeed, again, the surveys and studies show that a majority, overwhelming majority of African Americans are satisfied with their local police department, with four times more very satisfied than very unsatisfied. What you're seeing is a very small group on the streets that, just like the Detroit riots of 1967, is not representative of the entire community. Meanwhile, more studies that have confirmed that, yes, George Soros sent money to fund the riots. And in fact, able to get federal and state funding diverted to those groups involved with and connected to the rioting and the looting as well. That's the benefit of your tax dollars when billionaires are able to leverage their political influence to achieve it and attain it. Not everyone has gone along with this mindset and mentality, and that includes the Archbishop Vigano, whose powerful letter to President Trump described this as a response to the riots and the looting as an eternal struggle between good and evil that is playing out for the world to see. The Archbishop explained that the president should continue to fight the rioting, and noting and doing so on behalf of the children of light against the forces of darkness, as he would describe it. In the same context and capacity, we should realize that part of the reason the riots occurred and part of the reason the president is seeing difficult polling at the moment is the lockdown response to the pandemic. Another study points out that black unemployment, which, remember, under the president, black unemployment in general had reached its lowest levels on modern record history. But in particular, unemployment amongst African Americans and Latinos had reached historical lows under President Trump. Now that has skyrocketed. Black unemployment rate rises while white joblessness falls. Indeed, the gap between black and white unemployment has narrowed, but the majority of the black population is not working right now. due to the lockdown effects. The lockdown created the predicate by which the Antifa-aligned groups and BLM could unleash the looting and rioting we're seeing on the street in many degrees and for many regards. In the same context, of course, the rioting was not limited to here. It took place in Brussels. It took place in London. It took place in Paris. As this headline reads, Brussels burns. Riots break out at Black Lives Matter protest. Remember, Black Lives Matter is a very short-lived organization that somehow has international ties and international tentacles. People should ask how that came to be and why that is. In the same capacity in dealing with the issues related to the pandemic and how it disproportionately hurt the working class and set the template for what we're witnessing today, consider this headline. The results are in for remote learning. It did not work. Indeed, if you dig in further, the biggest problems are overwhelmingly with working class kids. So working class families were not particularly well equipped to suddenly become school teachers overnight. For upper middle class parents, that was an easier transition. But for working class parents, it was not. So now, not only were they disproportionately laid off, now not only are they disproportionately dealing with the looting, but one of the side effects of it, they are also disproportionately elderly in the nursing home. Those that are in nursing homes rather than more sophisticated facilities are also disproportionately working class. They were disproportionately victims of all the governors having infected patients being sent in to those nursing homes, enforcing the kind of death panels that both Bill Gates and George Soros had championed in the past. And now their children are falling behind educationally because the public schools were shut down. And in fact, charter schools and private schools were not allowed to function and operate. So we're seeing a continuous pattern of the same course of behavior. Meanwhile, there has been increasing calls to identify the white van that has been seen in multiple suspicious contexts. We look at image 13, and it looks like your generic white van, because the most interesting story to unravel potential conspiracy theories about how, or simple criminal conspiracy allegations about how these riots grew up so quickly, how they seemed so organized, how they appeared to be across the globe, not just across the country, is the mysterious appearance of these bricks. Bricks that were found in city after city after city. My brother-in-law and son also attended one of the protests in Las Vegas, saw the same thing. No one could explain how it was that these bricks were just showing up in these like big categories that appeared to be near construction sites but weren't related to the construction sites. Instead, they appeared to be a form of networked revolts. Well, this photo, this image 13, is after one of the vans that pulled away from one of the locations, and they're seeing it connected, similar white vans just like this, connected in multiple cities and multiple places to what is taking place and transpiring. So maybe that will unravel some of the organization and orchestration of these riots and looting that disproportionately have injured the very communities that the lockdown and the looting was supposed to be supporting or backing. When we come back, we're going to be talking about another topic and subject, whether or not AIDS itself, the disease, was the result of a rushed vaccine.
You are about to embark on a great debate.
Welcome back to American Countdown. For this segment of the show, we're going to be discussing the possibility of whether or not a rushed vaccine is simply a good idea. And for that, we can and should look at history. There is still the talk out there of rushing a COVID-19 vaccine out to the public. The president has even talked about the possibility of using the military to distribute the vaccine. There are those who suggest that that is a questionable idea at best. Indeed, the history of rushing vaccines in any context have tended not to work out well, but particularly in the flu context when in 1976 it resulted in far more damage and far more injuries than the virus itself ever did cause that year. It ended up being a CBS 60 Minutes story several years later, back when you could sue vaccine makers. These days, after those developments took place in the early mid-1980s, there was a push by the vaccine industry to make them immune from any lawsuits related to childhood vaccines, instead creating kind of an administrative court in Washington, D.C. called the Vaccine Court. which would not allow any discovery into whether there's anything problematic to the vaccines, allowed for strict liability. If an injury was caused by a vaccine, some amount would be awarded by an administrative judge. But most critically, it prevented the juries from hearing about what was happening with vaccines and most essentially prevented discovery into whether the vaccines were safe and what behaviors were taking place on the behalf and at the behest of Big Pharma. Big Pharma used vaccines as sort of the magic, almost like it had a magical properties. Like you can take a chemical drug, create it, manufacture it, distribute it, give it to people, and all of the risks that take place with any other drug, risk in terms of whether or not it's a good chemical compound and has been properly tested for safety purposes on all populations and in all circumstances. Secondly, whether or not the drug was simply made right at the producer level, at the maker level. Secondly, whether or not anything happened to it in the distribution of it. Fourth, whether anything went wrong in terms of a doctor or nurse giving it, either prescribing it or how it was given, given the circumstances or situation that might apply. All of them magically immune overnight. And you could no longer have discovery into what they did and why they did it and how they did it or anything else. And it also removed the deterrence. Instead, suddenly that drug, if it was called anything else, would be subject to legal scrutiny and jury scrutiny. Magically, you just put a different label on it. You no longer called it a drug. You called it a vaccine. And if you called it a vaccine, it was magically immune from questions or criticism. Indeed, to this very day, if you simply question vaccines, the media, the press, the institutional narrative will immediately isolate you and marginalize you and put you outside the community. You're a, quote, anti-vaxxer. As if questioning a particular vaccine or a particular vaccine legal system means that you believe every drug ever made that's a vaccine should never be available. Indeed, I have not found anyone yet that's an actual pure anti-vaxxer. Everyone that I've met that has questions about vaccines that I've studied or read or reviewed, they usually just simply have questions about a particular vaccine or the timing of when a vaccine is given or whether all vaccines are good or whether a rushed vaccine is a good idea. Put down simply, they're willing to be skeptical of Big Pharma. And in almost every case, their skepticism of Big Pharma is rooted in their life experience. It's their life experience, particularly, for example, take the famous vaccine autism debate. That arose simply because a lot of families started, people who are complete believers in vaccines, saw injuries to their children in a close time frame to when a vaccine was given to them that led them to believe there could be a causative relationship between the two. And they were being denied their lived experience, their learned experience, their observed experience, which is the foundation of all investigation, evidence, and science, by the medical establishment and the media establishment. Because for Big Pharma, the vaccine is the magic pill that makes what they do sound wonderful and great and grand. Not that they're just money grubbers out to make a penny, nickel, dime, or dollar any way they can. Not because there's a long history of those in the white lab coats misusing and abusing their power, whether at the corporate or individual level, to propagate their particular agenda on the world, of which there is a lot of both. Indeed, if you go through the long history of medicine, it looks more like witchcraft than it does look like science. Going, if we go back centuries, heck, we can just go back 100 years and see a lot of the insanity that was being propounded as medicine. So the idea that we should always defer to the white lab coats, that we should always defer to Big Pharma, has not been an approach that has usually worked for the protection of the public's best interest. So many of these parents started raising these questions, and they in turn reached out to a gastroenterologist in London who was a well-regarded, well-respected scholar at a after practicing for many years at a Royal School of Medicine there in the UK, asking about the connection between autism and a stomach disorder, which was his area of expertise. He simply reported several years later, by the way, they report a connection between taking the three different vaccines of MMR, which used to be given separately and given at different times. And beginning in the 90s, they started to consolidate all three and gave them at an earlier time frame. So it became one vaccine, taking the three separate ones into one, giving it at one time, giving it between the ages of 12 and 18 months. And that the parents reported in their life experience, their learned experience, their observed experience, that there was a connection between that particular vaccine, the timing in which their child received the vaccine, and they believed the onset of certain conditions related to the child's autism. and given the explosion of autism in the Western world, there were many questions about what the source of this explosion was, because the common scientific definition that, oh, it's actually in your genetic ancestry can't explain the dramatic rise in incidence of occurrence. So he simply reported in his report that there was a connection between autism and the stomach disorder. And during this time frame, he'd gone out and tried to find alternative vaccines. He'd researched the MMR vaccine in particular. He ended up reaching out to lawyers who were willing to challenge it. They ended up paying him as part of that process to do the research. All of that would somehow become bad acts, by the way, in the future. But all the study reported is, by the way, parents report there's a connection between autism and vaccines in this particular vaccine, given at this particular time frame. We don't report anything. We have no conclusion, something for future study. Well, it led to such an onslaught of media coverage and negativity. Big Pharma would wage a personal war against him. And within 10 years, this is a person who would be completely defrocked, have his medical license taken away, have Bill Gates defame him on a regular basis on CNN with Anderson Cooper, who was also happy to defame him on a regular basis. And that's the mindset and mentality when simply one person asked one question about one vaccine, and that's it. All he was questioning is it the best idea to give MMR at the same time in one vaccine between 12 and 18 months when MMR did not go through the diligent safety studies that the separate individual vaccines had done, and given that there was evidence that giving it at the same time at that age could be at risk for certain populations. Indeed, the CDC had discovered the same in 2004, but then hid and suppressed the data, which would come out later in a movie documentary called Vaxxed, which would go through that whole story. But the topic was so controversial that Robert De Niro had to pull the film from the Tribeca Film Festival. This is the mindset and mentality around the word vaccine. Somehow it's a magical dose, like manna from heaven, that anybody who questions it is insane and simply wants your child to die. That's the narrative pushed by the press. But indeed, we should look back, not only the CBS 60 Minutes about the swine flu vaccine and the disasters that happened in the 1970s, or the billions of dollars that have been paid out in the last two decades by the vaccine court, which is giving out the lowest amount it can for all of the known injuries caused by vaccines, also suppressed by the press, for the unusual immunity vaccine companies enjoy from liability from their courses of conduct and their actions in ways that no other industry in America has. You don't need immunity if you've done nothing wrong. You need immunity when you believe you can be prosecuted for doing something wrong. And when you're given the kind of immunity that big vaccine companies were given, that Big Pharma was given, for what has turned out in many cases very profitable vaccines, then you know there's something wrong. Indeed, if you listen to the core pitch that happened to lead to that legislation in the first place, it was there was so much risk with vaccines that they believed they would get sued out into oblivion if they were allowed to function. Well, what they're really saying is that if juries had an honest evidence and honest information and an honest opportunity to judge vaccines, they would conclude they cause more risk than benefit. That's what they're really saying. That's what they're really implicitly admitting in getting that legislation in the first place. We should not be afraid to question things that the media holds up as so holy and sacred and sacrosanct that it is the name that cannot be mentioned or the topic that cannot be discussed. In that same capacity, we should take a look at one particular issue of a rushed vaccine and what horrendous consequences it may have caused, which a person stumbled on as a reporter back in the 1990s. That is whether or not AIDS was actually the product of a rushed vaccine from the 1950s. The story was that a potential rushed vaccine used the various tissue of a chimpanzee, and that the chimpanzee is the only known animal to carry the corollary to HIV. And the official story from various members of the press and the institutional medical class was, no, somebody just somehow ate a chimpanzee and somehow that's how it transmitted, even there was no history of it and it didn't start occurring until the 1980s. Their explanation never was that satisfactory for many. Some that tried to study it ended up dying in the jungles trying to study it in Africa, sometimes under suspicious circumstances as well. Indeed, that led to a reporter to write a book called The River, where he stumbled upon an experiment that was taking place in the late 1950s in the Congo in Africa. Indeed, he found the same locations that was giving a particular exploratory experimental rushed vaccine, a certain form of vaccine for oral vaccine for polio by a prominent scientist who was competing with others who was using a different vaccine to see whether they could have success in Russia and Eastern Europe that ultimately became marketed in the United States, is the core of the story. That, in fact, where he was giving that vaccine corresponded to the same place that AIDS would explode about 20 years later. The potential reason for the delay in timing is the vaccine was all given to children. And because AIDS was a disease primarily transmitted by being sexually active, this could explain the time lag in when the virus took place. Indeed, there was also evidence that a Belgian doctor had found examples of HIV not long after the vaccine was given out to people, all the way back to the late 1950s. Now, for the further context of that, you have to know the story of the Congo. Once I understood that this all occurred in the Congo and that AIDS broke out originated in the Congo, then I could understand how a vaccine experiment could be related to it. It's not a coincidence that they chose the Congo to experiment on a local population. For that, you have to go back about a century before. Indeed, if you look at it, what would happen in West Africa, that particular part of Congo around the Congo River had been decimated by the various slave trading and slave raiding that had taken place in the century in between the late 1700s and late 1800s, leaving many of the tribes vulnerable. When famously Stanley Livingston went through that area exploring it, quote-unquote, he was more of a barbarian than he was an adventurer. But putting that part of the story aside, he found a very vulnerable place to take over. He had the benefits of a benefactor, the insane King Leopold from Belgium, who recently popped up in the news because there was talks of trying to take down his statue. That's one statue I'm all in favor of taking down. King Leopold had a horrific and horrendous history, experimented and treated Congo was his personal possession, not the possession of the Belgian government, his personal possession for almost 30 years. He basically used them as slave in the name of preventing the slave trade. Here was the media propaganda of the day. In fact, the media propaganda would continue for almost 70 years in one way, shape, or form, whether it was when King Leopold controlled it up until 1909 or until the Belgian government controlled it up until 1961. The whole background of what took place there was the brutality that took place. Indeed, one of the writers who famously exposed it was none other than Lord Conrad. Conrad went there to work on the ships, believing the propaganda. The propaganda was that King Leopold had come and saved the Congo from the slave traders. He was there on a humanitarian gesture to help the local population. This, by the way, King Leopold was a guy who in his spare time, his favorite thing to do was rape 12-year-old girls, particularly he preferred virgins. That's who King Leopold was. But not according to the New York Times at the time. If you read the New York Times at the time, he was a great humanitarian, trying to extend his human well-being to protect the African population from slave traders. When in fact, he was facilitating the slave trade, of course. He would also raid it for its rubber, raid it for a wide range of other resources. And if you didn't go along with him, he would often kidnap people or he would cut people's hands or feet off. Indeed, the irony is that Antwerp in Belgium is a place that's known for the symbols of hands because the legend is that they killed a giant there in order to be able to trade there centuries before by cutting off the giant's hands. So often you'll see these disconnected hands in statues and memoriams in Antwerp in Belgium where King Leopold held court. But that had a whole different meaning if you were in the Belgian Congo at the time. So it was one of the most horrific, horrendous managements of governments, of colonial governments, and the king having it as personal property for almost a quarter of a century of any in African history. Indeed, he was on pace to complete genocide. He had wiped out almost half of the local population within a decade of being present there because of his demand for rubber and other extractionistic tactics and techniques that led to the human risk of so many people there. That ultimately led, in fact, the second great disaster of Belgium that's relevant to this time period when this rushed vaccine was taking place is Patrice Lumumba. Lumumba was the great democratic hope of Africa, not just Congo. He was elected. He was going to bring a sort of democratic impulse and democratic streak, little d democratic streak, to the African continent. It was at a key time between the colonial and post-colonial governments of Africa for all of Europe. And what happened, of course, is Eisenhower first and the CIA first tried to get him killed repeatedly, failed in their efforts. So instead, they co-opted and bought off a local police and army commander who would later rule the Congo for and rename it Zaire decades later. And it also deprived the not only the Belgian Congo, but Africa itself of its great democratic hope and opportunity at a critical time period. So once you know that is the mindset and the mentality of the leadership and governance in the Belgian Congo, it should not surprise you that that would be a place someone who wanted to experiment on a local population for a rushed vaccine would go. It's a place where they could contaminate the data. It's a place where they could lie about what took place. It's a place where they could use any wide range of sources for the tissue to use the vaccine. It's the kind of place they could experiment on a large population and likely see no resistance then or in the future because of the degree of severe colonial control the Belgians occupied to such a degree they would assassinate and kill someone like Patrice Lumumba, the great hope of the country and of the whole continent. In that context, we'll show you a clip first from King Leopold Ghost about the nature of who King Leopold was. There's a great book on the topic and there's a movie on the topic. Let's just show you the trailer so you get a sense of what the environment was like, what was seeded in the Belgian Congo to allow a rushed vaccine to occur that may have led to AIDS. First, let's show video clip number 3.
I believe we must set up 3 children's colonies. The aim of these colonies is, above all, to furnish us with soldiers.
It was unusual in tightly knit African tribes for parentless children to be sent away, but many were orphaned because the force publique had killed their parents. These were the only state-funded schools for children in Leopold's Africa. Disease was rife and the death rate high.
Several of the little girls were so sickly on their arrival that our good sisters couldn't save them, but all had the happiness of receiving holy baptism. They are now little angels in heaven who are praying for our great king.
At the turn of the century, the worldwide rubber boom exploded.
This is the time when electricity spreads throughout the Western world. So rubber is essential, not just for automobile tires, but for anything and everything that had to do with electric wires. And that explains why rubber prices were so high.
Nowhere did the boom have a greater impact than in the Congo, where rubber vines snaked high into the rainforests that covered half of Leopold's colony. The king had gone into debt with his Congo investments, but the return on rubber would surpass all his expectations.
Rubber was not the most valuable product. Ivory was much more valuable, but rubber was what mattered. Leopold financed his colony on the back of rubber.
We passed a man on the road who had broken his back by falling from a tree while tapping some vines.
Rubber is a sap which must be congealed to be carried. The only method the workers typically had in the forest was to spread it over their bodies as they worked. It caused excruciating pain when it was peeled away.
People were afraid of this work. Nobody would agree to take this work on his own. No, they were rather arresting them, chasing them up to their home, and they would tie their hands with chains and send them on the rubber job.
Mm. Red Rubber Terror began in the 1890s. Two horrifying decades followed of murder and madness in return for profit. Villages were assigned exact rubber quotas. Forced to meet accelerating demands, tappers scattered widely through the jungle, often climbing trees 100 feet off the ground. They could make a small incision at the base of the vine to tap it, or whack through the vine entirely. This produced rubber quickly but killed the vine. In a perverse reversal of production management, tappers were severely punished for not making their quotas, as well as for making their quotas, but killing the vine.
The native doesn't like making rubber. He must be compelled to do it.
Soldiers arrive in a village, start looting, take all the chickens, grain, goats, and finally they seize the women. These women are kept hostage until the chief brings in the required number of kilograms of rubber.
Sometimes women were held hostage. Sometimes children. Sometimes elders or chiefs. The wives of villagers who resisted were killed, but often died anyway in the stockades, where food was scarce and conditions harsh.
The women taken during the last raid are causing me no end of trouble. All these soldiers want one. The sentries who are supposed to watch them unchain the prettiest ones and rape them.
That is the mindset and mentality that seized the Congo and its devastation that led to a certain cultural control over a place like it, to the degree that someone like a scientist wanting to experiment on a population would go to. So now let's go to the B start, which will continue at the after the break. The documentary that goes into the issues related to the river, the book written by the journalist that goes to whether or not the origin of HIV can come from a polio vaccine experimentation that took place in the Belgian Congo in the late 1950s. Let's start clip number 5.
$26 million dead, $40 million infected, and a continent, Africa, devastated. In 20 years, AIDS has become the worst medical catastrophe ever experienced by humankind.
100 million people in the next 50 years are going to die of HIV disease, prematurely. It's not a disease like cancer of old people. It's a disease of young people, and it's one of the great human tragedies of all time. The West has ignored it. Ronald Reagan ignored it. George Bush Sr. ignored it. Bill Clinton ignored it, and it has spread and spread and spread and spread. And so we are facing a human tragedy of incredible proportions.
How AIDS first appeared. Like all diseases, unless we understand its origins, we have little hope of finding a cure or a vaccine.
We're not going to be able to hide from this one. Okay. Some have said, look, this is just not going to go away. And it's just human nature. It's a historical question. You could say it's almost not scientific. When you've got something of this importance, the mind just says, well, where did it come from?
The origins of AIDS remains a mystery about which the scientific community has long kept silent. Lack of interest, or fear of knowing. Yet isolated voices have dared to question and attempted to break the silence. Following the footsteps of a few dedicated men to where it all began, Africa, we were able to locate some of the places and people involved in the genesis of this terrible human tragedy. HIV, the contributing virus of AIDS, was first isolated in 1983 by Luc Montagnier and Françoise Barré-Sinoussi's teams at the Pasteur Institute in Paris. Simon Wayne Hobson was among them.
When this first came, people thought that this bomb from nowhere necessitated sort of novel explanations. And no one really knew. There was no cousin, if you wish, to this sort of virus known in the animal kingdom at that point.
But this cousin did exist, and in 1989, researchers identified it in one animal, the chimpanzee. They named it SIV, simian immunodeficiency virus, analogous to HIV, human immunodeficiency virus. The similarities between the two viruses prompted researchers to designate SIV as the ancestor of HIV. But how did SIV become HIV and infect man?
Chimpanzees are very similar to humans, as you know. Their genetic components are very similar to ours. And one would think if you took HIV and injected it into a chimp, that they would develop AIDS. But the interesting thing is that they don't.
When we come back after the break, we'll get into the rest of this part of this documentary and describe whether or not AIDS was the product of a rushed vaccine.
Aerodyne Technology Delivery System. The first of its kind, pure, nascent atomic iodine that can be delivered through a spray bottle. The next level of innovation of X2 is here. Introducing Survival Shield X2 Spray. The great part about the X2 Spray is it's great on the go. When you've got it in the dropper, it's great at your house. It's, you know, great at work. But this is great for the car. It's great to keep with you. And, again, it's also good for the throat and mouth to get the effects of iodine, not to just ingest it into the stomach. We're really excited about it. It's 33% off out of the gates. It was listeners' idea asking for us to come up with a spray bottle that had us talk to the scientists and developers and come up with a system that aerosolizes it and delivers it to the body in a new and in some ways even better way. Get your Survival Shield X2 nascent iodine spray now at 33% off at InfoWarsStore.com and experience the power of aerosolized X2 nascent iodine for yourself.
Welcome back to American Countdown. Let's join the documentary that goes into good detail, and we'll go into, this is just part of it, explaining how, in fact, AIDS may have resulted, and likely did, from a rushed vaccine in Africa a half century ago.
Items that I know in science today, they don't get infected with HIV, they get well. Now, why don't humans do this? Why is it that you can take a chimpanzee and inject them with a large, large amount of HIV, the chimp will go through a period in which he has circulating HIV in his blood. He will develop antibodies just as humans will. And then the HIV disappears. And you can't find it anymore. So from that point of view, chimps are absolutely fascinating.
The immediate precursor to the virus that's going around the world is chimpanzees. We all agreed on that. We can discuss when, why, how, but we all agree on the chimpanzee. So when, There is a, I think there's a consensus to say it's this century. Where? Clearly, the epicenter in humans is the northeast Zaire, Uganda. The epidemic sort of started from there.
During the 1950s, this region, Zaire, was called the Belgian Congo. Blood samples were collected here in 1959 by an American researcher and a Belgian physician, Joseph van der Piet.
J'ai écrit avec Motulski après avoir fait le tour du Congo en incluant certaines parties donc du Rwanda et du Burundi. Et nous avons prélevé presque 2000 sérums d'adultes et c'est beaucoup plus tard qu'il les a donnés à des experts pour voir s'il n'y avait pas de traces de HIV. Or, il y a un laboratoire qui a trouvé un seul sérum séropositif et ça a été confirmé par plusieurs autres laboratoires. Et je crois que dans la littérature en général, on considère ça le premier sérum séropositif pour le sida avant l'ère du sida. Le numéro était L70 et elle vient de Léopoldville.
We have the date, 1959, and the place, Léopoldville. Former capital of the Belgian Congo, today known as Kinshasa. The first evidence of AIDS emerged from Central Africa more than 20 years before the rise of the HIV/AIDS epidemic in America.
So if you went back and said, well, HIV is related to SIV, to the monkey AIDS virus, where do humans have contact with monkeys? Well, the average person has no contact with monkeys. There are only two ways that you could have contact with monkeys that I can figure. One is you have people who eat monkeys, and in so doing, they clean the monkey and with a sharp knife or a dull knife or what have you and can become infected that way. The other way is that we still, or that we used vaccines that were made from monkeys that we injected into people.
The AIDS virus can only be transmitted through contact with blood or mucosa. Most in the scientific community favor the Hunter theory, which suggests the occurrence of an accident during which man could have become infected with contaminated chimpanzee blood. However, this theory fails to explain why AIDS appeared so recently, when chimpanzees have been hunted across Africa for thousands of years. But there exists another, more disturbing theory. In 1992, an independent journalist, Tom Curtis, published an article with unexpected consequences.
I had a source in California, an AIDS treatment activist, who sent me a packet of clips one day saying, this is a bombshell story waiting for an investigative reporter. What I had been sent was a couple of documents saying, well, it's all very well and good to talk about these bizarre tribal rituals or other possible explanations of the cause of AIDS, but it is a fact that the virus, the monkey virus, SV40, was transmitted to millions of people across the world. And they sort of planted the suggestion that something similar might have happened with AIDS.
This revelation was a bombshell. Tom Curtis speculated that if during the 50s polio vaccines were contaminated with the monkey virus SV40, something similar could have happened with AIDS. SIV, the ancestor of the AIDS virus, is also a monkey virus. And Curtis connected this fact to a mass polio vaccination campaign in the Congo.
It looked at the polio campaign that Dr. Kaprowski had undertaken in the former Belgian Congo in the middle to late 1950s. And I did focus on that campaign because of certain geographic similarities to where scientists were saying AIDS had begun in the human population, which was in this same region.
And this particular region of Africa is the epicenter of the AIDS epidemic. Curtis's hypothesis jolted the scientific community because it implicated one of its own, Hilary Koprowski, a renowned researcher and pioneer in the fight against polio.
There was a tremendous feeling in the scientific community that they were somehow endangered. If you had journalists writing articles in the Rolling Stone, my God, what about our dignity? So there was a lot of concern from that viewpoint. There was a lot of concern that it was written by a person who was a professional journalist, and that they were afraid that people would no longer immunize their children against polio.
How could a simian virus possibly contaminate a vaccine? Curtis's argument was extremely serious because it put in question the manufacturing of polio vaccine, one of modern medicine's greatest triumphs. To understand what could have happened, we have to return to the polio years. In 1958, America was beginning to recover from a scourge that had haunted it for more than 50 years, polio. The disease, still incurable at the time, paralyzed and killed, mostly children. $90 million Americans were vaccinated in one of the largest mass vaccination campaigns ever. Polio vaccine, one of modern medicine's greatest successes, made its inventor, Jonas Salk, a hero.
164 million Americans, to say nothing of all the other people in the world, that will profit from your discovery. I am very, very happy to hand that to you.
But polio vaccine had one distinctive feature. It was the first to be derived from monkey organs. Mass commercialization began and gave rise to the development of an enormous market for monkeys, used both as test animals and as raw material from which to create the polio vaccine. Entire shipments of macaque arrived in America from India and the Philippines.
To make primary cultures of monkey kidneys, you needed monkey kidneys. You needed flasks or bottles. You needed culture medium. And this was usually supplemented with fetal calf serum or with horse serum, which was used extensively. And you were in business. One obtains a piece of tissue, and then one divides it. And the way you divide it is you, first of all, in the crudest sense, you take a pair of scissors, and you snip, 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 until you have a suspension of cells that is relatively crude. That is, there are lumps and bumps in there. Put them into the flasks. Let them settle down and make a monolayer of cells. Add poliovirus, and then you would collect the liquid from the cultures. Filter out the cells, remove the cell remains, and then you would have a virus suspension. And then you could kill it with formaldehyde, put it into bottles, and call it polio vaccine. That was it. So trying to get entirely pure cultures as primary cultures is very difficult. You can have a culture of monkey kidney cells that looks to be very pure. But if you look at those on the surface, or if you stain them, or you look with a special microscope, you can see that there are other cell types present in there.
And other viruses could have infected these other cells. Driven to eradicate one disease, we risked creating another. Scientists and governmental organizations knew this. The powerful Food and Drug Administration was aware of the risks, but kept the information hidden.
It was the researcher, Bernice Eddy, at the Food and Drug Administration, who first had indications that these viruses existed, and her findings were essentially suppressed. There is a lot of inner discussion within FDA of her taking examples of mouse tumors to her supervisors, and they're seemingly being biased against the possibility that this could be a nasty virus. She did, however, present her work at a New York meeting, to which, again, she was criticized for doing that. Subsequently, Dr. Sweet and Dr. Hillerman found the same virus, having heard about it, and named it SV40.
During this same period, the terminology for these monkey viruses was established and published in the medical literature. SV40 was only the 40th virus in a very long list.
We should have stopped using monkey kidney tissues, I think, for virus production in 1960. And we've continued to do so. The drug companies are the ones who really determine this. They have developed facilities, they develop processes that would cost them a lot of money if they had to do it a different way. The thing that makes me physically angry is the fact that we now have the genetic ability to make synthetic polio vaccine from recombinant proteins, and we are not doing it. That we continue to take ground-up monkey parts and inject them into children.
Using monkeys to manufacture vaccines was and still remains dangerous. Curtis's basis for his theory was correct. Polio vaccines at the time were contaminated with a monkey virus. But that didn't explain the appearance of AIDS. Curtis proposed that Koprowski made his vaccine using a monkey other than the macaque, the African green monkey. But this was a mistake. The African green monkey does carry an SIV, but this is not the direct ancestor of HIV-1, our AIDS virus.
Hilary Koprowski felt that his honor had been defiled and that he had been done serious injury. The Rolling Stone folded under and publicly apologized for having published the article. And that was, as they say, that for the time being.
I thought, you know, people should think for themselves and evaluate the evidence, decide. And mostly, I thought they should simply test the vaccine to find out whether this theory had merit or not, because theories are the way scientific knowledge advances. And even theories that turn out not to be true help advance scientific knowledge. So I felt it was a legitimate question, and I felt a little bit under siege by the medical community and the and some in the science press and so on, who were acting like I was an apostate, you know.
Hilary Koprowski, the man Curtis had attacked, is a well-known and respected scientist, a pioneer of research into rabies and polio. He is also an expert on cancer and AIDS. Back in the polio years, Hilary Koprowski was a young Polish researcher. Brilliant and ambitious, he was determined to make a name for himself in his newly adopted country, the USA. In 1950, he secretly tested his first prototype of a live oral polio vaccine on 20 handicapped children at Letchworth Village in New York State. When the scientific community learned that Hilary Koprowski was experimenting on human beings, it was a scandal, even though the test was deemed to have done no harm. The community's condemnation of Koprowski's secret research led to the loss of official support for his work, with preference shifting to Jonas Salk's injected polio vaccine. But Kaprowski refused to quit. With the support of a large pharmaceutical company, Lederle, he proceeded to test different versions of his oral polio vaccine on small groups of human subjects. 52 at Sonoma, 53 at Letchworth Village, 54 at Woodbine, and 55 at Clinton Farms. A tragic event lent him unexpected support. On April the 23rd, 1955, 260 children injected with Salk's vaccine became sick. 11 died. The investigation showed that some of the Salk vaccine lots were defective. Confidence in Salk's injected vaccine was shaken, clearing the way for Kaprowski to assert himself. But he was now no longer alone. Another scientific giant, Albert Sabin, announced his intention to develop an attenuated live vaccine.
And on the one hand, you had Albert Sabin, who looked on this as an enormous challenge. On the other hand, Hillary approached it from the standpoint that, yes, this was a challenge. Yes, this was a medical problem. Yes, it was going to be interesting to solve it. And yes, we'll go off and do it by whatever means that are available to us, that are legal. So you have these two conflicting individuals who are all working towards the same goal. And it's one of the great dramas of modern times of how they interacted and how they worked. They were willing to go and take subjects who may or may not have been informed of what they were doing. They were willing to go to the backside of the moon if it meant that they could find out whether or not they had a viable product.
To win this race, they have to test. And to test, they need the largest possible population of non-immunized people, something no longer available in America. The first to prove the reliability and safety of his vaccine will be the winner. Sabin makes a secret deal with his native country, the USSR, where he will vaccinate more than 6 million people in Latvia, Estonia, and Kazakhstan. Kaprowski chooses an African country, the Belgian Congo, a long-standing possession of King Leopold and the jewel of his colonial empire. Because of the Congo's uranium mines, commercial accords had existed between America and Belgium since the Second World War. This was also a country with one of Africa's best organized and most modern healthcare infrastructures.
L'Institut Princess Astrid est un des laboratoires médicaux les plus importants et les plus complets de l'Afrique centrale. Il dispose d'un personnel nombreux et d'un matériel ultra-moderne tant pour l'exécution des analyses courantes que pour la recherche scientifique et la préparation de vaccins et sérums utilisés dans la lutte contre diverses maladies infectieuses. La sollicitude des services officiels s'étend spécialement aux enfants, l'avenir même du pays. Dès l'école, tous les enfants sont soumis à des examens médicaux et à cette occasion reçoivent un carnet de santé, véritable fiche d'identité sanitaire.
The efficient organization of medical records made the local population extremely suitable for experimentation.
Return to political quiet after the recent disturbances. Leopoldville engages in an all-out fight against infantile paralysis, crowding every clinic with mothers and their children. The latter to receive orally administered shots of a new vaccine against the scourge of childhood. It is a live virus preparation developed in the United States by Philadelphia's Dr. Hillary Kaprowski. And it differs from our famed Salk vaccine in that it does away with injections. And it must taste good if the children's receptivity to it is a criterion.
Hillary Kaprowski went to the Congo and took people who had been abused, mistreated, and had been the victims of, if you want to put it that way, of colonial expansion for nearly 100 years, and used them. The ethics of that, I don't think, occurred to anyone at the time. The opportunity was there. It was legal. It was allowed by the Belgian government. They went in and did their job, and that was it. No big deal.
Sabin and Kaprowski conducted their experiments at the same time with the same type of vaccine. No AIDS cases were detected in Russia, but in the Congo, the first known HIV infections surfaced a couple of years after the start of the vaccinations. Was it coincidental, or was there, as Curtis suggested, something different with Kaprowski's vaccine? To get a definitive answer, Curtis had tried to get the vaccine used in the Congo tested, something Cecil Fox had wanted to do in 1985.
When I went to the Food and Drug Administration as a government employee to ask if I could obtain early lots of polio vaccine to test for the presence of sequences or presence of viruses in them, I was told that they didn't exist. Well, I was told they did exist. But something happened.
Indeed, something happened. What happened is they used the chimpanzee tissue from their kidneys to create a polio vaccine just for the Belgian Congo that may have been the source of AIDS, which killed far more than polio ever could imagine. That is, in fact, what may have occurred. That's the dangers of rushed vaccines. That's the dangers of giving too much power to people in white lab coats. That's why we should be careful going forward.